Welcome to the One White Teacher Podcast. My name is Nene White, and I am so glad to be able to share this conversation with you. So I've just shared a wonderful conversation with Fats Kirkman, and I thought that it would be a really important conversation for all of us to share in, because I'm white, and I am of an age where I really never tuned into hip hop or rap or any of it. And I thought I'm probably not the only one. And the reason that I thought it would be really good to share a conversation with Fats is because he gives the background, the history, the foundations for why hip hop was manifest in the first place. So it's an interesting conversation. He gives us a sample of his own version of rap, which he calls conscious rap. And rap, he explains, has, of course, when you think about it, has many different expressions, and they come from many different places. And he goes into that. It's an interesting and worthwhile conversation, I feel. And I also feel that for teachers, we need to appreciate and learn to appreciate expressions that are outside of our own cultural comfort zones. And that's why I really value this conversation. I'm so appreciative to Fats for sharing time with us. All right, I hope you enjoy. And you'll see some really good follow-up material at the end of this conversation if you're interested. Okay, thank you. Jason Fats Kirkman is an author, a musician, a dancer, master of ceremonies, a teacher. He has been homeschooling his teenage sons from the get-go, and he is an entrepreneur. Jason Fats Kirkman has been a hip-hop culturalist representing Hampton Roads, Virginia for over 30 years. So this man knows what he's talking about.
So hello, Fats. It's great to see you again.
Hello, Nene. How are you doing today?
Wonderful, wonderful. You have introduced me to the culture of hip hop, and I really appreciate that. And I have about a million questions, as you know. Do you mind if we start out with your name?
Yes. My name is Jason, AKA Fats Kirkman. That's my name. I'm an MC. I'm Fat. My name is Fats. People often ask where Fats comes from.
Yes.
I'm only 135 pounds. So, yeah. So Fats comes from, it's my MC name. I'm an MC slash rapper. I've been doing that for, 29 years now. Yes. I've been MCing for 29 years. I've been practicing the knowledge of self element since before then, since I was like 16, maybe 35, 40 years. I'm a B-boy. I break dance. So I break dance. I do the knowledge, and I'm an MC. Those are the, out of the five primary elements of hip hop, those are the three that I practice.
Okay. And MC is kind of the same as DJ?
No. MC is a master of the ceremony. MC right. To people. And rap, people outside of the culture will call MC a rapper. So inside hip hop culture, we deem what people call the rapper, the MC. Rakim, he actually did an original spelling of it, and we adopted that into the culture, E-M-C-E-E. So okay. Once he did that. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I really appreciate that you understand that you're going to have to be very patient with this incredibly, ridiculously segregated white woman here. So thank you. My curiosity is very sincere. So yeah. So an MC, so that means that you make your own rap?
Yes. Yeah, I write my own. I write my own. Yeah, all of my material. Yeah, I write all my own stuff. I feel like that's I personally feel like that's a prerequisite for being an MC. As opposed to a rapper. One of the big conflicts that we've been having in our culture is a rapper versus an MC. So there are lists of things that a rapper does that MCs don't, that MCs do, that rappers don't. They're similar in a lot of ways, but there are some differences. And one of the main differences is that a true MC will never have anyone else write their rhymes. Whereas in the music industry, a lot of rappers, Drake's, a lot of people have other people write raps for them.
Okay. I forgot to ask you this before in our preparations, but excuse me if I'm putting you on the spot now, but can we get a sample of one of your raps sometime that I could put into this? Just a sample? Whenever. I mean, I need to learn how to hear it, how to listen to it, so that it goes for me. I can get beyond the emotion of it, which is usually so intense and tending towards anger, though not all of it does. But right.
Mine's done. You know, my frustration through my lyricism comes with the system or, you know, the government, the powers that be. But as far as an outlash of anger that I'm pushing towards my crowd, no, it's an enlightening, it's a frustrating anger. But yeah, I can bust what we call a hot 16 for you if you would like, no problem.
Cool. I would really appreciate that because, you know, once I kind of got aware, a bit more aware that I'm working on, it's kind of painful to realize how unaware I have been and how unplugged in I've been. So yeah, I would really, really appreciate that. And I will share that with some of what you let me share with listeners too.
No problem.
Cool. No problem. Wonderful. Thank you. So this book that you've written, Off Stage, The Culture of Hip Hop Before the Elements, is a fascinating read. And it's a fascinating read. And so, I mean, even the terms, the culture of hip hop and before the elements, the culture of hip hop, the fact that there is a culture, I didn't quite get. So if you want to explain that to us, and then if you want to say, I guess elements are what make up the culture of hip hop. So we need to unpack what the elements are. So.
Okay. All right. So the clarity is, and to be honest, Nene, you're learning hip hop in a manner, I'm not trying to, you know, brag or nothing on me per se, but what I'm saying is you, by getting my book first, you're getting the actual culture before most of the world was able even to get the proper aspect of the culture. Okay, so here we go. The culture of hip hop before the elements means really this. So basically, if someone, let's say 5 to 7 years ago, right? You're at a hip hop conference and you're trying to find out about hip hop. And you was like, okay, what is hip hop? More likely someone would have listed the elements to you. There are five primary elements. A lot of people lack the knowledge of self aspect of it. That's one of the elements, but they would often say b-boying, graffiti, DJing, and MCing, right? Mm-hmm. So those are the four elements of hip hop. And for a long time, that's all people would explain what hip hop culture was. They would just kind of give you those four elements, right? But if you look at the definition of culture, right? But they say hip hop is a culture, right? And it is. But if you just look at b-boying, DJ, graph writing, and MCing as just the culture, then you're limiting it to what culture really is by definition. And a culture by definition is a people's beliefs, you know, ideas, beliefs, and arts, beliefs, social behavior patterns, right? So on one end, if you say hip hop is b-boying, graph writing, DJing, MCing, which a lot of people say because a lot of people have made the mistake of saying that hip hop culture started in 1973 with Kool Herc. That's all you're going to get are these elements, these artistic elements. Mm-hmm. But if we look at that definition we just said, art is just one part of that definition. Mm-hmm. What is hip hop's social belief, social behavior patterns? What are hip hop's beliefs? Mm-hmm. What do people in hip hop believe in? And to make it make it more clear, what does a hip hop person do when they're not DJing, b-boying, graph writing, and MCing? What does a hip hop person do when they're not doing that? That's why my book is titled Off Stage. So what does a hip hop person do when they're not entertaining everybody or when we're not just partying, because mm-hmm. partying and b-boying and rhyming is definitely an aspect. It's an expression of the people of the culture. It's a celebration. But what do the people of hip hop do? You know, right. KRS-One made a statement. He said, rap is something you do. Hip hop is something you live.
Yeah.
And we've lived with that. That's what he meant. I in my book, I say, let's add those other elements too, as to what people in hip hop do. Yep, we graph right. Yep, we DJ. But do everybody in hip hop culture DJ? No. Is yeah. everybody in hip hop culture rap? No. Right. Right. You know what I mean? And what this and what that musical aspect did is it eliminated the women's involvement. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
we overlooked the women's role and what they did in hip hop. Let me give you an example. Okay, so a lot of parties were thrown, right? Hip hop was the sanctuary of hip hop, which was created by Kool Herc, was mostly parties. But if you look close in my research, who made the phone calls for the parties? Who rented the stuff? It was the women. Yeah. Successful hip hop parties are predicated on the presence of women. A successful hip hop sanctuary is more women than men. Yeah. And as a personal testament, going to clubs back in the day and everything, fights broke out for two reasons in a club. Number one, the DJ was whack, or there were not enough women in the club. So you have all combination of both. So you have alcohol, testosterone, all these people from the hood, broke, disenfranchised people in the hood, no women to talk to, the DJ's not playing the music I like, boom, 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 boom. A lot of stuff would kind of break out because of that or whatever. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I really appreciate that explanation. What I really deeply appreciate about that explanation you just gave us is that it weaves everything together into the whole that, of course, is the foundation of everything else, is the heart and soul of the people.
And, right.
Right. So thank you. And you did it in a way that really makes sense. And you brought in women, which, you know, women really appreciate that when men appreciate that they are a logical and a factual and an actual contribution to the balance of everything.
Yeah, there is no culture without women. How do you do that?
Right, right.
how do we all get here? You know what
I mean? So, right. Yeah. I mean, we all need each other, and women is part of that. Yeah.
Right. So, they've been in it the whole time, and that's something. Like I said in my book, I did a chapter.
Yeah.
Sad to say, of course, it was hard to find.
Yeah.
The contributions of women, but I found a few that I felt are very pivotal. Their contributions they would seem small, but when you look at the grand scheme of how hip hop came into be, without these women, a lot of things wouldn't be here.
Right. So, it's interesting, all the different pieces that just kept making it happen. Like this man who had unimaginable power, completely out of whack, Robert Moses.
Yes.
Making decisions for the neighborhoods that were so, so inhumane. And so wrong. Do you want to talk about him and why his shameful decision making resulted in what we're talking about today?
Yes, you can start with the Federal Highway Act of 1956. Franklin D. Roosevelt passed that. So that people don't realize that's when the interstates came together. You know, they did a project, okay, we got to start connecting the states. However, a lot of old African-American communities and minority communities were ran through, not just right. Robert Moses in New York. This was a national thing that was going on.
Right.
It's just that Robert Moses is significant in hip hop history because it's New York.
Right.
And basically it's interesting because we all, when I was in the Zulu Nation, now in the Zulu Union, I heard Robert Moses' name kept coming up. You know, Robert Moses built I-95, Robert Moses built I-95. So his name rings in our history. So when I wrote the book, I was like, well, let me dig on this dude a little bit more. And that's when I realized, I was like, oh, you know, I didn't know he had so much control.
Yeah.
So, you know, after World War II, he had ended up with a bunch of funding, to make a long story short. But he had federal, state, and local positions. So nothing
at the same time.
So nothing got done in New York without his authority. for many years. I think from like 40, I don't know, like 48 to 70 something. He planned, he designed it. Everybody had to go through him. He built the Empire State Building, but the United Nations building. Most of these projects we're talking about, he built all of those. He built those, and he built 415 miles of highway. He built all the over 150 playgrounds. It's interesting, his accomplishments. I'm like, wow, he did a lot of work, but he did it without caring, you know, without caring for people. So some people say, when I did my research, that when he started building the plans for the interstates, you know, America was still segregated.
Right.
So his plan was to literally segregate New York using interstate systems. Right. Whereas people who had money needed a way to get to Manhattan from their suburbs. So, you know, he was doing things like trying to decrease public transportation. Of course, poor people need public transportation. So right. He just did not seem to care for the less fortunate. You know what I mean? Was over 60,000 people were affected. You know what I mean? By his projects or whatever. And then he also, again, building the projects that we talk about, that everybody comes from, the tower, he called it a tower and a park project. Basically, where he would just stack people, you know, how New York projects are, and build 15, 16 stories high, bad plumbing, da 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 da, over time or whatever. But it was his objective was to use as least amount of real estate as possible to stack all of these people that were coming into New York. Because the migrants from Puerto Rico, a lot of people that were coming from a lot of countries just kind of coming into New York for work at that time. So he was just trying to build interstates, build projects, and do all kinds of things to kind of put people here, put people there, put the undesirables there, put his friends there, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So, undesirables. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And so the result of that, I mean, the conditions were terrible. Trash wasn't getting picked up. People in those neighborhoods were trying to go through the standard channels to get, you know, some attention so that things could be corrected. Am I right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, yeah. As best they could. Yeah.
Yeah. And so nothing happens. So we all know how that would feel. It doesn't take much imagination at all.
Right.
And so, anybody would relate to how people felt at that time. But I don't know if all of us would relate to the responses that created hip hop. So have you got enough of a lead in for that to start talking about that now, how that happened?
Well, the thing is interesting because I think when you look at that, the objective was we're going to build I-95 and then we're going to just leave the South Bronx alone. That's really, I mean, in policy, Richard Nixon, his Patrick Moynihan, I think I'm pronouncing that right. I always get that last name mixed up. Moynihan, he was Richard Nixon's affairs. He was his like urban affairs guy on the committee or whatever. Yeah. And he just basically told Richard Nixon that, you know, that this plight of racism with African-Americans could use what's called benign neglect. And so benign neglect is by definition, you're responsible for something that you don't care to be responsible for.
Right.
But it is your responsibility to take care of people, but you don't care for these people or something. And so you're just really gonna neglect it. You're gonna neglect it. You're gonna leave them alone. And so that's what they did, even down to certain public policies. Roger Starr in 1976, I think it was one of the commissioners in New York at the time, he did a plan, it's called Plan Shrinkage. And the Plan Shrinkage was designed to cut police departments, cut fire departments, cut the garbage people, and cut the subways from pretty much the south part of the Bronx, or the South Bronx. Meanwhile, people are being moved into the South Bronx because of the interstate.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And so there, people are being crammed, white flights taking place. This neighborhood was in the 60s, when they started building the interstate, it was a vibrant neighborhood of Italians, Jews, you know, things like that, jobs, factories. As time went on, white flight took place and all these jobs and factories left. Again, it's not just New York, it's a national thing.
Yeah.
But New York is probably the most extreme in my research of neighborhoods that I've ever seen people be left in. as far as garbage. But like when you watch documentaries on the history of hip hop, you'll see children literally climbing over garbage to go to school. You know, you'll see there were over 6,000 abandoned buildings in the Bronx. There at one time in the I think it was 75, in 1 month, it was like 60 something fires. It was like a fire, two, three fires a day. So what was happening was the landlords were paying some of the gang members and young kids like $50 to burn these buildings down. And they collected millions of dollars in insurance settlements. So that's what they were doing. You know, it was, you know, just like a gentrification pretty much. Let's just leave these people alone. They'll move out, we'll tear it down, and we'll build it back up to be what we want it to be. Yeah. But instead, the children created hip hop. And I don't think that they expected that to happen at all. You know what I mean? So that's why I love hip hop, because even in its conditions, this is the part, the culture, the part of hip hop that gets overlooked. Right. People talk about the gang aspects. They talk right. about the effects of the New York government at that time. Right. But they don't necessarily really harp on the social aspect of it. What right. were those children doing? And right. people don't connect these gangs, or what they were calling these groups that were dealing with this at the time, with the people who were doing the b-boying and stuff in the future. Right. These are the same people, you know, and people don't make that. A lot of times, because people start hip hop in 73, we don't get the opportunity to make that connection.
And I'm just going to go back a little bit, because I just want to make the point right now, because I think it's important for us to realize this. Right here in California, we have a place called Golden Gate Village that's low-income housing, and it's basically Black residents. Mm-hmm. And the county has for 10 years, they call it, or it's called here, it's called demolition by neglect, instead of benign neglect.
Benign neglect, yes.
So I mean, you know, that's going on still. There's a bunch of us citizens who have made our voices so loud, mainly white citizens, because actually, you know, there's a lot of white people that are saying, what has been going on? We, you know, now that we're starting to realize it and getting out of our miseducation and the blinders that have been purposely put on us, we are speaking up now, and we got the main guy that was in charge of that demolition by neglect. We got him out of here.
Excellent.
Yes. So I want people to know that this isn't just about hip hop, or it's just not just about, you know, the high, it's just, and all of it connects. And it's relevant to all of us. It's relevant to our life. It's relevant to the health of the nation. It's relevant to your family. It's relevant to my family.
Definitely.
And
definitely.
So learning is the first stage, but it's not the final stage. So, I just need people to know, just like you were saying, it's all over the country. Yeah, it's in my backyard.
Yeah. Like I said, still going down. They had three. I'm in from Norfolk here in Virginia. There are three project housing, establishments that are. They're all being. I guess a casino is supposed to be getting put up here soon. So there are three projects. We're talking 5,000 to 7,000 people, 4,800 children. All three. One of them are already gone. Tidewater Park is gone. Then Youngs Park and Curry Park are going to be torn down next. So the saga continues. You know what I mean?
It does.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So thank you for letting me do that aside. But I think it's very relevant that we realize we're not just talking about history. We're talking about right now. And these are patterns that need to be, we need to be. Yeah. Yeah.
That continues. See, it's interesting. And in my one of the conversations I was having on a panel about that, and I was trying to explain to someone the issue, because about that, this is why we need to understand the culture before the elements, because if you look at hip hop now or rap music, we're talking about music moguls. We're talking billionaires and millionaires that are now in so-called hip hop culture. However, we're still going through the same things that the people who created hip hop were going through. Police brutality, gentrification, you know, da 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 da. And I would also like to add, as far as the white people and the white factor, white people have also been here the whole time. What the media likes to do is completely try to separate us. So I'll bring in our history. So even when you look at history of hip hop, you'll see, you'll hear about the Ghetto Brothers, you hear about the Black Spades, right? So you'll think, okay, Black Spades, definitely Black folks, Ghetto Brothers, definitely Latino, Latino ran. There were none of these organizations were without white people. People don't realize that, but everybody white didn't make it the white flight. And that's the part that I think a lot of people need to realize. So each one of these gangs had white people in it. Black Spades had whites. Ghetto Brothers had whites. So it's not, and the KRS-One Dean, KRS-One Dean, Martin Luther King, KRS-One has also deemed hip hop as Martin Luther King's dream, the manifestation of it. And in the early days, that was exactly right. The Latinos, whites, and blacks were together in the struggle. Even when you look at Chicago, Fred Hampton, he got with the white organizations, and then everybody got the Rainbow Coalition, if you will.
That was the
collaboration of whites, blacks.
Yeah.
Blacks and Latinos again, for the right call. The people don't even realize this. What was her name? Jane Fonda.
Yeah.
I don't think I saw this documentary one time, a Black Panther documentary. And in the documentary, it the camera went around, so a bunch of Black Panthers in berets and guns. And then you looked up and you saw this white girl. It was Jane Fonda.
Yeah, yeah.
Holding a Black baby. And in the text, they were like, yeah, this is Jane Fonda's house.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So Jane Fonda, Marlon Brando completely supported the Black Panther Party, or at least their ideals. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So there are a lot of people don't want to let people know that.
Right. But
whites have always been,
you
know, it's just you're heavily populated. So it seems that more of you have not been privy to what's going on. But enough of you actually have. It's just that not a people are really being exposed to it. And I learned that once I started traveling through the Zulu Nation, through hip hop culture for real.
Okay, you've said Zulu Nation a couple of times now. I have no idea what that is.
The Zulu Nation is an organization that was started by Afrika Bambaataa. It has now been dismantled because of some acts that he had done. That's a whole nother stream. That's a whole nother interview. But the Zulu Nation was an organization that was started from the Black Spades. You say you read my book, you saw the Black Spades. The Zulu Nation was a spinoff organization of that started, but it lasted all the way up to, I was in the Zulu Nation, my wife was in, I represented the Zulu Nation chapter. It became an international organization. I represented Chapter 30 here in VA. So we were all over the world. Our largest chapter was in France. But yes, it was a hip hop, it was an international hip hop organization.
Wow. We need to understand this. This is American history. It's not just.
Oh, yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So let's see. Okay. So you went in a couple of directions that I wanted to make sure not to lose the thread of, like the fact that, what is your mindset about the fact that some famous people are making a lot of money in the rap industry? How do you process that fact? What is that?
Okay, let's do it like this. Okay, let's go to 1979. Okay, all right. So from 73 to 78 is when hip hop's musical manifestation took place. Okay, so by 1978, everybody in the Bronx, there was all DJs started to have little rap groups, rappers was coming up and things like that. However, they were using other people's music. So hip hop in the 70s is not rap music. It's salsa, reggae, it's funk. It's a collaboration of everybody's music. So they knew, even if you watch the Get Down, if you ever want to learn more about hip hop too, Nene, watch, it's a series that Grandmaster Flash put together called the Get Down. I think it was on Netflix. Check it out. That'll definitely help you out. You know what I mean? He did. It's his vision of it. So it's still Hollywoodish, but it's pretty accurate. It's pretty accurate. Okay. So in 78, hip hop had manifested itself as a folk music, if you will, like a Bronx folk music. That was it. They had no intention on making no records, none of that at all.
Right.
Okay. So Sylvia Robinson, who was a doo-wop artist at the time, comes along, starts Sugar Hill Records, to make a long story short, and she drops Rapper's Delight. You know, and she drops the song Rapper's Delight from the Sugar Hill Gang, right? She put Sugar Hill Gang together and they dropped Rapper's Delight. Some people say that 1979 is the first death of hip hop, because when that happened, everybody that was doing, nobody knew who the Sugar Hill Gang was, right? So they did not, they were not a part of the original hip hop community. But now rap music was born. This is the difference. So you got hip hop up to that song come is released. Now it's rap music because it's now put on record and can be sold. However, the people who originally came up with this music, they know what was going on. So they had to stop, drop doing their parties, which was all they was really trying to do, and put a record together. And thus, now we have a multi-billion dollar corporation where the culture has no control. So for the people in the culture, they had to start now. Their new fight wasn't the community. It was now being a celebrity and trying to fight the music industry racially, trying to get their money right, trying to learn the game, not necessarily knowing the game and stuff like that or whatever. Yeah. So your Jay-Z's, your moguls of today. Me personally, I feel like, and me and my Zulu Union brothers have discussed this, they are more concerned with being celebrities than serving the community.
And entertaining.
And entertaining. Now, again, they're under certain contracts where they can't do certain things. They don't have a lot of time. They got a lot of raw songs, a lot of tours, a lot of stuff they got to do, be on the radio, be on TV, and all that stuff. So their obligations are now to the music industry. Therefore, they have completely lost touch with the community. And thus, we're still getting gentrified. But it's sad because these same moguls are rapping about these neighborhoods that are being gentrified. You know what I mean? So there's a disconnect there. So yeah, like I said, there's a disconnect there with people, because now their obligation is to the music industry.
Yeah.
You know, they'll rap about the neighborhood. They'll do a video in the neighborhood flashing their jewelry, but the neighborhood tow up. So they got a necklace on their neck that's worth more than the house they rhyming in front of. You know what I mean? And so there's a disconnect there. So, but they want to say they like keep people say what they say, you know, we always hear the term keeping it real or things like that. That's kind of one of the stipulations of keeping it real. You know, are you keeping it real with yourself? Are you keeping it real with your community? And oftentimes people are not in the music industry. That's pretty much how I look at it. I'm disappointed. I used to be start raving mad, but that's not good for the spirit. And you can't judge people. So I'm like, okay, I moved it down to disappointment. And and this is one of the reasons why this book is written. I've been rhyming for 29 years, trying to get in the music industry, did some soul searching. COVID really helped me with this. I wrote the book before COVID, but COVID really brought home how from now on, before I get on anybody's stage and grab a mic, I better be giving away some food. I better be doing something for something in the community. So I feel that it needs to be an obligation. Any event we're going to do from now on, people need to bring a canned good or some perishables, non-perishables, or some clothes so we can start giving away. People are in need. It's bad out here. So, we represent all the neighborhoods and stuff.
Wow, that's just like two different universes, entertainment and the authentic, real channels of what it's supposed to be expressing.
Exactly. Two totally different things. And then a lot of these guys who started this original stuff now, some of these names we're listing from 73 to 78 are the very ones in the game kind of wanting us to kind of celebrate what they did in hip hop, but not give back to the communities. You know what I mean? So,
One thing I appreciated in your writing was how the challenges and, I'm really going to this thought from what we were just talking about, you know, because people have a certain amount of success and then they'll either go in this direction or that direction or that direction, you know, it'll take them in different, depending on, as you said somewhere, when challenges happen, they're kind of a mirror for your character.
Yes.
You wrote that in the book, and I really appreciated that quote because, you know, people try very hard to not have hard times, you know, and sure, of course, we all want to be happy and comfortable and have fun and play and party. But it's important to know that the challenges are where that self-knowledge, that opportunity to grow, that opportunity to contribute, that opportunity to self-examine, just, and that's what the hip hop has done. I mean, that's what you've helped to reveal is what the real thing of hip hop was. And so, yeah. And so I really appreciate you bringing that. I don't know that I would be having this conversation if it didn't go to that deep level. So thank you for that, Fats. You know, because
I really appreciate that, because that's important. I'm glad that statement, because that statement touched me. You know, when you're writing things, you rhymes or books, anything, a lot of it is divine. You know, it's my choice, it's my will, if you will, my willpower that has willed me to write the book, but it's still coming through, you know, divinely, in my opinion. And that statement touched me the same way, because that's true. I realized that, you know, challenges are one necessary. You're gonna have them, right? Right. And that right there is where your soul gets chiseled to me. That's where everything gets defined. Like I said, what's the challenge? What's there if all good, you're rich and everything is cool or whatever the case may be, but then rich people have challenges too. So, you know, the challenges though, that's what defined you. That's why we haven't defined hip hop as deep and as well as we should as a society in America and the world, because we overlook, people wanted to, I guess, people have romanticized the story of hip hop, I guess, to try to make it fit and make everybody enjoy it or whatever, you know what I mean? That's one of the problems that I've always had, because when I first learned it, I learned the romanticized version, only to find out like, oh, okay, so, you know, when you really look at what these children were going through. And that's another thing, the average age of people who started hip hop was 9 to say 24, 25, living through these conditions. I tell people all the time, you're 14 years old, right? You look at the newspaper, buildings are burning in your neighborhood, asbestos is in the air, heroin is rampant, 1,500 men are dying of a heroin overdose. It's out of chain. The city don't seem to be doing nothing about it. The police department has stopped coming to your neighborhoods, and when they come into your neighborhoods, they're selling drugs. And then the fire department doesn't stop coming, buildings are burning down. And then you get a newspaper, and Gerald Ford says, drop dead New York. New York drop dead. You're 14. How does that make you feel? School programs are closing. All you had the trumpet, they had to take your trumpet. And Rich, and the president of the United States literally says in a big newspaper article, New York drop dead. You want to talk about some adversity? You know, for me, you know what I mean? I could not imagine that. You know what I mean? And so for those children to make the decisions that they made, for us to be here right now talking about hip hop, then it will always be amazing to me. It will always be amazing to me, because they took challenges that some people are scared to do now.
Yeah.
They took them head on without their parents, by themselves, and was like, all right, look, you know what I mean? We're gonna organize ourselves, and we're gonna get and because people don't realize this, but the organizations and everything that those children did in the Bronx at that time, that was the only thing going for them, was what they was creating themselves. Sure. Everything else.
Oh, you just cut out. You just cut out.
No, it's my phone. Somebody was trying to call me. I'm on my phone.
Oh.
Yeah, we're good.
All right. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, the last sentence cut out, but I'll edit that out. So now what I want to have this make sense is I need to hear a cut of something, of some rap or some, I don't even know what to call it, I'm sorry, but a sample.
One of my raps?
Yeah, so that I can, you know, I get the theory now, I get the foundation, I get the philosophy, but now I need an example of what you're talking about to really, you know, bring it home and own it.
Okay, before I say it, I'll explain to you the different styles of rap, of course. You got what I call criminology, so people always rhyme about shooting and killing and stuff like that.
Yeah, and then you have the swear words and saying bad things on women, and you know, that's all I've heard about, yeah.
The misogyny, exactly. Yeah. And then there's conscious rap, Talib Kweli, Common, you know, people like that. So people would describe me and my wife and my group as a conscious rap group. Okay. So here's a high 16 from me.
Okay.
Time to execute. The plan is to memorize songs from Strange Fruit. Now let the energy or the root of me show balance with infinity. The streets ministry theology spits geometry and Deuteronomy. So see, It can be hard to follow me, but allow me to be free, to drop science spiritually. Now, it's the profound poetry that be up in the shows, be a soul controlling your soul, be it cordless or recorded. Oh, Lord, close, African with the woolly fro. Soul will glow when I master my chakras and surpass the doctor. Holler for the father, no need to lust a dollar. If it ain't good for a ticket on the mothership, brother, don't bother. Some things I say may be hard to swallow, but if you inhale and breathe, it's healing that you won't believe. With verbals that'll bring weakness and people to their knees with atomic bombs and the palms to reflect the manner of degree. And I don't do flattery or expect you to be mad at me, for I am either and or pumping heat in front of the record store, in front of the door. I'm being hard. Core about how this conscious MC would not be having this no more.
Oh my god.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh, thank you. Wow.
Thank you.
Wow.
Sorry, I just have to take that in. I'm going to replay that a few hundred times. Wow.
Thank you. I'll send you. You're my homie. I'll send you a lot of our stuff. I'll start sending you some.
Oh, I would love that.
Oh yeah.
Because
give me
that
email
just
address.
Brings it home. That brings it home.
I appreciate it.
With your explanation, and then to conscious rap, you call it.
Mm-hmm. That's what a lot of people call it. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That's a perfect way to describe it too. That is, wow. Thank you. Okay. Catch my breath. Wow.
Thank you.
Okay. I've never heard anything like that. You know,
yeah, wait till you hear my wife.
Oh, I want to hear her.
Oh, yeah. No, we're going to send you, me and her, we're a duo called the Rubber People. Yeah. I'll send you some of our stuff.
These names blow my mind. I don't know what to think. Where did that come from? Where did that come
from? The Rubber People are another name for the Olmecs. I don't know if you ever heard of the Olmecs, but the Olmecs were the people who were here in the Western Hemisphere before Christopher Columbus. The Olmecs are the ancestors of the Aztecs, the Incas, and the Mayans. So the Olmecs were here before them, but they are some of the original people of the Western Hemisphere. So that's why we named it. And, you know, rubber, our lyrics are rubber, lyric flexibility. We flex on the mic, stuff like that. But yeah, the Rubber People.
Oh, very cool. Very cool.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Wow. All right. So let's talk a little bit about writing now, which is, people like me understand that as graffiti, and people mm-hmm. like me go, oh. So.
Yes,
sorry,
ma'am.
Sorry again. I apologize again. But so.
No apology necessary.
Thank you. I've heard that several times, that it's just the miseducation is, yeah. But so your thoughts on writing?
Well, on writing?
Yes.
Through my research, a lot of writers, when you ask them why they were doing what they were doing, it gets writing started in, and another misconception is writing kind of took place in New York. It started in Philadelphia in 1965 during the hip hop history with the person named Cornbread. And when you ask Cornbread and other graph writers, when I would watch their documentaries and stuff, they would say, yo man, we were the ones that weren't in the gangs. We were the kids who didn't want to, they didn't want to be no gang violence. We didn't want none of that nonsense or whatever. So, but we wanted popularity. We wanted to get our name up. And most important, the city didn't care. My neighborhood was getting towed up. The city did not seem to care. So I did not think that the city would care that I was just doing. And as a matter of fact, when you look at old New York, some of that graffiti on them trains was some of the prettiest things you would see in New York some of those days, right?
Right.
So the graffiti writers were young kids, or some of them were Vietnam vets, people that went AWOL from the Vietnam War, stuff like that or whatever. So.
Yeah.
There's a mixture of a lot of people who were doing it, all races, by the way. Let's clear that too. White, black, and Latino were all graph writing, not just black, not just like all black, white, and a lot of good white ones too. The way I can name good, great graph writers or whatever, of all races or whatever. But that was really their thing. They were just kind of, again, what we described earlier, and how New York was, the Bronx was, Robert Moses is just kind of building that interstate or whatever. Some of the subways won't really get into them anyway. And so they just found that, and New York was so neglectful. New York was so bad.
Yes.
People don't realize this. When you look at graph writing, How is a city a responsible city if they could put up so much graffiti on the trains? That's how broke New York was. That's how bad they were managing their money. They did not have the police manpower to even stop it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so, but that was really an expression of whenever you watch a graffiti documentary, you're going to hear them constantly say, we were not trying to impress nobody but us. Graffiti is a code that we're watching them talk to themselves. They're talking to each other. They're not talking to none of us. They don't care if we, none of us who don't do it, see it. It doesn't matter to them. They are literally having a conversation with each other. You know what I mean? And so, and so it was a socio, and it wasn't really, again, I thought when I was first taught it, hip hop culture, it was taught like, okay, they cut the art programs. So da, 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 da. When I do my research, the Manhattan High School of Art and Design, the first graph writing kings, if you will, the first popular ones, they came out of there. DeWitt Clinton High School, a lot of them came out of there in the Bronx. You know what I mean? So a lot of these kids were not dropouts. A lot of these kids that were doing it would go to school, or sometimes, yeah, they play hooky from school to go plant that train in the morning, or they go paint that train in the morning and then go to school. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so the graffiti in of itself wasn't necessarily those trips. People don't realize that, because now me and you read my book a little bit, me and you talking right now. Now we understand the conditions of New York at that time. Right. Let's look at these 14 to 16 to 18 year old children. What do they have to lose? Who's looking out for me? Who, I don't care. Oh, people care. What? People care about the train? Cops are selling dope out here.
Right.
Cops are criminals. Even if you look, you can see the movie American Hustler with Denzel Washington, where he was Frank Lucas, when he played Frank Lucas. That movie displayed clearly how the New York Police Department was crooked. Frank Lucas and the New York Department did like a $56 million heroin empire. You know what I mean? Wow. So the children, as far as children painting on trains, they was like, I don't think nobody paying me no mind. You know what I mean? I don't think nobody really cares. They can't really seem to stop it from going on. See, it was just a way that they was able to express themselves. I thought it was rebellion until I did the research. I'm like, nah, they weren't even trying to be rebellious or nothing. It was just like, well, the city won't doing nothing with nobody anyway. The neighborhood was so up. Y'all let Robin Moses come through here sick. Buildings are being burnt every day. Who cares that I'm on this train?
Right.
And that's the way they, and that's the way they look. And that was their expression. And these were the kids who were not in the gangs, right? So when at least graffiti started with the gangs, because the gangs used to mark territory. So when you do graffiti history, the first tags and things you see were not on trains. They were on buildings, they were on walls, and it was gangs marking their territory.
Okay.
You know what I mean? But as graffiti evolved, the trains started to get hit around 1970. Manhattan was the first place. Manhattan's 1, 3, and A lines were the first lines to ever be hit with graffiti. and once again, these weren't people rebellious against the city per se, because again, the city was toe up. These children didn't think anything of that anybody even cared. You know what I mean? Because the neighborhood was already kind of vandalized anyway. And so they were like, all right, well, I start painting these trains. I don't know who the first person to paint the train. I need to find that out. That's probably going to be hard to find, but they revolutionized it. And now it was called becoming a king and getting your name up all over the city. See, the people don't realize that, but graffiti started a lot of the mentality of even the musical aspect of hip hop, where people like, I'm the best. I'm the king of New York. That started with graffiti. That started with graffiti, the graph writers. And also, without graffiti, we're probably not here. Hip-hop probably doesn't hit the mainstream. Hip-hop does not get exposed a lot. The graffiti writers were the first ones where newspapers would kind of interview these people. You know, you got news reporters walking around New York like, yo, who is doing this?
Yeah.
Then they'll find a guy, a young dude spraying, then they'll interview him. Put him in a newspaper. Now we got 5,000 more graph writers who feel like they can be popular now or whatever. And so in actuality, the media is what helped. You got three instances. A guy named Sandy Padway in Philadelphia interviewed Cornbread and the Northwest Philly writer crew. Interviewed them, put them in the magazine. So everybody was like, oh, word? I can get, oh my gracious. And then in New York, Taki 183, which was New York's first icon and king, according to our history. But he was a messenger dude. So he in New York on a bike delivering stuff. So he just had him a little marker, tagging. But you start to see his name on buses, mailboxes, trash cans, buildings. And so everybody was like, yo, who is this Taki 183 guy? And he was influenced by a guy named Julio 204. when you see, you're going to see in graffiti, you see numbers, Taki 183, Julio 204, Tracy 168. These numbers are the street that they lived on. They were representing their street. You know what I mean? And so, but as far as the graffiti culture, it was, I guess it was some rebellion, but really these were the kids who didn't want no violence. The artists, the art kids, they were like, I ain't trying to fight. I'm a lover, not a fighter.
Yeah.
But let me go down here and paint this street. Well, let me go down here and make my name like this instead of killing people and being in a gang. I'm gonna go down here and do my art. You know what I mean? So it was, and that's really all it really was, you know, really just ignore children who were ignored, but telling you in the city, oh, you're not gonna ignore me. You will see my name all over the city.
Right. I appreciate that. And also that ties into something that you said in the very beginning of this conversation about self-knowledge.
Yes, knowledge of self.
And knowledge of self, and then self-expression.
Mm-hmm.
Because where else can they express themselves? I mean, people will express themselves. And if it gets constricted too much, it's going to pop out somehow.
You're creating a bomb, exactly. Yeah, you're creating a spiritual bomb, and that's what children were. They were the children of the Bronx back then. They were crying.
Right.
We were being ignored. That's what that graffiti was telling everybody. We were crying, and the people who were getting on trains were like, "Oh man, who's doing all this stuff? These children, y'all ignoring. Y'all not paying them any attention. They're not getting any attention. And a lot of their moms, a lot of their people are strung out. A lot of their parents are strung out and stuff like that. So these children are not getting the attention they want. So I'm gonna grab this can.
Yeah,
I'm gonna go steal these cans and I'm gonna go out here and do my thing. You know what I mean? So that's in of itself, that's really what it was.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, that just makes sense. Yeah.
I was teaching hip hop to the inner city youth, and I know a lot of times we'll go in a rec center, and when we start talking about graffiti, you know, people used to do us like this. And I had to tell people, oh no, we're not telling people to go do it now.
Yeah,
we're teaching you of the conditions that were going on then. Right, we're not encouraging children to do it now. Now graffiti can be sold for $10,000 in a museum. So I tell children, if you want to do graffiti, frame it. Frame it and go sell it.
So it's interesting because seems like pretty much every element of the hip hop culture graduated into being commercialized and profit-making.
Yes, exactly. Right. And graffiti was the first one.
Yeah. And graffiti was the first one before rap?
Yes, ma'am.
I mean,
yes, ma'am.
Graffiti was commercialized and people made profit off of their graffiti?
There was an organization, there was a guy named Hugo Martinez in 1972, right? Mm. He was a social worker, but he was a gang advocate. So he would go talk to the gangs a lot, right? So he went up on the gangs and found out half these gang dudes was the ones paying these trains. Yeah. So he was like, okay. So he started this organization called the United Graffiti Artists. And they were selling pieces for $2,500, $8,000, grab pieces. That was 1972. Wow. And then in Fab Five Freddy and Basquiat, Shawn Michael Basquiat, you know, he was the graph writer Sammo at first. He was a graffiti writer. His name, he would type Sammo. He never hit a train, but he would hit buildings. But Basquiat, of course, we all know what happened with Sean Basquiat. You know what I mean? But he was right there with Fab Five Freddy back in the day painting them trains. Well, he wasn't painting trains, but he was painting on the walls. But Fab Five Freddy was the one who told graph writers, hey, y'all, let's get this money, man. So Fab Five Freddy had the best of both worlds. He had the hood. Fab Five Freddy could go to an African band bottle party in the hood, in the roughest hood. Oh! But then he could also go hang with the art people. The white art people in downtown, right? Soho and all them kind of places. So he would go hang with in Greenwich Village and all that and go hang with them. Mm-hmm. And so he was, in fact, Freddie was a graph writer. You know, he did a Andy Warhol tribute on a train, the Campbell suit. He did one, he painted that on a train for Andy Warhol. He was into that. So Fat Five Freddy was the one that was telling graph writers, hey man, let's do a gallery joint. And that's how that started. Let's take some graph writing out here. Let's put it on canvas. Let's frame it. Let's do a little art jank. I know some white people that stay into it a little bit. They don't know nothing about it. And they ate it up.
Wow.
Yep. So the graffiti is the first to break that commercial. Yeah, well, the first one to be like, yeah, now we're making money before rap. Yep.
It's a mad, 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 mad world, isn't it?
ain't it?
But they got real notice. So I love it. That's fascinating. I never would have known any of that.
Yeah.
So what is your motivation for sharing all of this story? Why are you motivated to write the book, to have this conversation with a one white teacher? You know, why are you here?
It's a new world, and what matters to me is what we were saying earlier about how hip hop was getting romanticized. So I was in an organization, I was in the Zulu Nation, and our baby, we had a grassroots organization in the Zulu Nation called ER Camp, Elements Recognized Community and Music Partnership. So we would go into inner cities, high schools, colleges, and teach the elements of hip hop, right? So again, we weren't teaching what I wrote about, because that wasn't being expressed enough. And so what happened was,
you say what you wrote about, you mean the deeper foundations and the real reason, the seeds of, okay.
The culture of hip hop. Oh no, you're good. The culture of hip hop before the elements, because I realized, like we were expressing earlier, people was always explaining hip hop with them four elements, just the artistic expression. So it's so that made it an incomplete explanation of the entire culture.
Exactly.
But I realized that, and I realized this, and to be honest with you, this is how I realized this. So one day I wanted to go to the Zulu Nation anniversary at the time. We were still in the Zulu Nation. Our money got funny, weren't able to go. So I said, you know what? Since I can't go to the anniversary, I'm gonna dive head in, because November is Hip Hop History Month, right? So that's when the Judo anniversary is. So November. So I was like, let me be hip hop. Let me be a historian this month. Let me go down this rabbit hole. Let me find, see if I can da da da. Boom. I go right on YouTube, and there's this one of my references in my book, Michael Wayne TV. He is up here, and KRS-One, he's still one of the greatest MCs of all time, but I've grown to not necessarily appreciate him and his views off stage. So KRS-One, whom everybody loves, to a fault, they idol worship him in our culture. He ended up being the first person to be caught romanticizing the story of hip hop. He lied about Afrika Bambaataa's accomplishments. He was lying right there. Michael Wayne has footage of him lying right there to people in college, bold-faced lying. And that story that he was telling was the same story that we was telling the kids. That broke my heart when I found that out. So I sat back, and the universe and God told me, write the book. So because I've been saying the idea, you write the book, write the book. You need to write a book on hip-hop. You need to write a book. Write the book, man. Write the book. And that in of itself is is the fuel for me. We can no longer think hip hop is just the artistic expression, because if you do, that's all we'll be talking about. So who's the greatest rapper of all time? And we'll be kind of focusing more on the musical aspect rather than the community, which is where hip hop started. Hip hop started with community activism. It started with looking out for your own and your community, and it was started by children. So I realized, well, man, the children need to know that not only does hip hop belong to them as a culture, but they need to know that it really started by taking care of themselves in the hood. That's how it started, before they started partying. They couldn't party the way they partied after 73 if 64 through 72 had not happened first. And so that's when I realized, okay, this has to get out. This has to happen. And then as I did that, you find there are many holes. So once I started researching, many holes are in our story. Many holes that need to be filled. Some things are being lied about. We got to pull certain stories out. And that's kind of what we're kind of going through right now as hip hop historians, people who are into hip hop pedagogy, who are trying to teach it, trying to get it into colleges. I wrote a syllabus with my book. I'm planning on it being a textbook one day. So I would like for, it to be put into a school or something where children can actually learn this aspect of hip hop culture. So that's my fuel. That's my motivation to reform information so that it is correct. So it is correct about hip hop culture. The babies are influenced by hip hop more than anything else in the world. So they need to know where it actually came from and how it actually started.
Yes.
And it didn't start with a break beat and it didn't start breakdancing. That's not where it started. So
thank
that's
you.
My motivation.
Thank you. Thank you. I hear you. I really hear you. How many kids do you have?
Two.
Okay. Boy and a girl? Mm-hmm.
Two boys.
Two boys. Me too. I have two boys.
Yeah.
So you're homeschooling them or you have, how old are they?
Yeah, they're 12 and 13, about to be 13 and 14. Yeah, they've never been to school. So we've been homeschooling them their whole lives.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And how does that work? I'm sorry, I'm shifting the conversation a little bit.
Oh, no, we're good. We're good. Yeah. I'm a teacher. You know, I'm a teacher. So I feel like it's the same interview. You know what I mean?
Great, I'm a teacher. I do too. Yeah.
Teacher is on my resume. That's why I love you. I was like, oh, one white teacher. Let's do this.
We
faculty. We faculty, homie. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So
the fact that you're homeschooling your kids, you and your wife, just shows the dedication to their healthy upbringing and their your concern that they not be miseducated and undereducated and so that they get some overstanding, which I love your term of overstanding instead of understanding. Can you give me an overview of the kind of things your curriculum for them? Just like for the kids now, when they're at this age, what kind of things are they studying?
Oh, I'll give you what we're going through right now. So right now I'm teaching three subjects. Our first class is our story. I got the timeline right here. you know what I mean? Hold on right quick.
Good. Oh my gosh. Wow.
Okay, so this is our story class, and my sons, one day we was in class, and of course the Christopher Columbus discovered America thing
came up.
And I was like, well, nah. And so we did a little project. It was called the American Africa Project. And so, but what we're doing now is deciphering everything that happened before Egypt too. Because people like romanticizing Egypt. Right. When you study Egypt. There were many things going on before Egypt, right? So we've compiled this timeline based on books that I have that I make in the textbooks. So, you know, for example, I'll take my book or somebody's book. And I'll type up some questions and make it a textbook. All right, y'all, we'll do it like that or whatever. So over many books and looking online and making them look through study and stuff, we come up with this timeline from Lucy Bones 3.2 million years ago.
Yeah.
Found them Lucy Bones. So my children was like, wait a minute, hold on. Somebody was here 3 million ago. Yep, according to archaeologists, the Lucy Bones was here in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
But we don't know what they were doing. So I do it in a noun sense. So it's the people, the places, and the things that they did. So this is the Lucy Bones, then this is the Nubians. So we started and we went on down there. So that's what we're doing. So our spring break is coming up. So during the spring equinox is when they'll be tested on this. And then we're going to take a spring break from the 28th through the 31st. Just kind of take it. We got to give me a break, get them a break. We've been doing really good. So this is class one. This is our story.
Yeah. You know
what I mean? This is what we're doing with that. And then our second class is, the second class is genealogy. So the first part of it is they're learning about RNA, DNA, genes, heredity, things like that or whatever. And how genes work and stuff and how we all the same and different like that. So that's phase one. Phase two, they're going to do their family tree after that. And phase three, this is a semester with them. I'm going to give them empty photo books, and we're going to take field trips to my mama house, my wife's mother's house, her daddy house, my sisters and them, and we're going to get old photos, and they're going to take that family tree that we put together and literally put it physically into a photo album. So I think it's very important that children know their family, their history, and their heritage. Mm-hmm. And I base myself just what I teach them when they come around and ask me questions. So they'll be like, yeah, who's my cousin? Mm-hmm. And when they asked me that, I said, well, you got a lot of cousins. Where are they? Mm-hmm. Good question. We're about to learn. Mm-hmm. And that's so genealogy is what we're doing. And then we're doing word science after lunch. What we're just doing right now, we're on what, prefixes, root words, and suffixes, the etymology of stuff and stuff. We're breaking down words. And then my wife teaches, she's right now teaching Tree of Life spirituality to them. So they're learning the Egyptian Tree of Life spiritual system. You know what I mean? So that's, they learn that as well. So that's what we're doing with them. Thanks for asking. I really love, I love it. They came up with the whole name. It's Key University. They came up with the name. They came up with the mascot. They came up with the colors. That make them feel like they're a part of it. That's the one thing I feel like we all need to do with our children. Instead of making them act like they're not people in the room, involve them. And they will actually be, they will actually be a lot of help. And they're very smarter than you. And they will help you a lot with stuff. Help you a lot with stuff too. So I've learned that.
They are the next step of evolution. They just are. Just like we were. But they are.
Exactly. What do you teach?
Well, I actually taught, you know, about social emotional learning. That was
a little bit.
Well, it's just getting kids, it's just that internal side of just real, you know, empathy and just social skills and listening and just the human part where you just, you know, it's not all about yourself, you know, it's like, but wow, I wasn't expecting that question. I haven't thought about it for a while. Like when George Floyd was murdered, I just, my whole world exploded, literally exploded.
Yeah, I broke down too.
Yeah. And I just, that's when I decided to learn what I completely obviously didn't know and create this podcast so that people would have conversations and then maybe I could share these conversations with other people. So
excellent. Yeah, George Floyd, I think George Floyd, for those of us that have hearts, in my opinion.
Yeah,
that broke me down because Amari Taylor had happened shortly before that. And then everybody kind of blew that one off a little bit. But then George Floyd was like a couple months or a month or two after that or something like that. And with COVID fresh, COVID was brand new. That was enough to drive. I was like, oh man, this is a lot. This is a lot. You know what I mean?
It was a lot. To watch it.
Yeah.
To watch it.
Yeah. I was like, oh man, this is bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So what I want to do now, you're going to, I feel like I've got a huge lights going on of understanding, and I so much appreciate it. And I have a understanding of how much more I need to understand, but that's way better than I came into this conversation. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So what more would you, what direction would you point us? I'm going to put up how people can get your book. And what else would you like people to know before we say goodbye?
Well, I just want everybody in the you know, everybody that's watching, you know, that's gonna see this, you know what I mean, to know that hip hop was designed without the people knowing it. It was designed, once I look at it from an objective historical point, that hip hop was literally designed to let everybody be aware of the fact that there's still more to be done. The children were lashing out. Some of them were, well, this integration thing ain't working. We're not ready. You know, we're not quite ready. Both sides, you know what I mean, are not necessarily ready for that. But it has been designed to, designed to train children into the leadership necessary to bring in this new world. That's its original design. But then when the musical aspect started and people started to interview these musical people of hip hop, that's where the stories stayed. And I just want everybody to know that hip hop as a culture started in 1964, not 1973. From 64 to 72, is when the actual, the element of knowledge of self,
knowledge
is full
of self.
Right, people say knowledge, but it's an original form in hip hop culture. It was knowledge of self. It is, and that's where it all comes into play. Having knowledge, gaining knowledge of your surroundings, knowing the situations that you're in or whatever.
About
that, and these are children. These are our children. So that's what I want people to take more than anything, that our children are leaders too. They have visions that we don't see. They look at things differently than we do. You know what I mean?
And thank goodness. Have,
yes. And they have a view that that gets ignored, that needs to be, that needs a lot of attention. That's really one more over what I want people to realize. It's like we forget. We're so concerned with how we feel that even in hip hop culture and documentaries, I'll show my sons hip hop documentaries and they laughing. I can't be mad at them. You know what they laughing at? The elders in the documentaries arguing amongst themselves. So we want the children to get along, but they're watching us not get along. Being more concerned with our views and how we feel about things and our emotions rather than how what we're doing, how that affects the children. We need to put more emphasis and attention on the children. That in of itself is my overall action. I didn't even know that until I finished writing the book. You know, you get many revelations when you when you're doing things. Yes. And so get more over with everybody that'll be witnessing this. That is what I want you to know, that hip hop is not just music at all. And I know people have been telling y'all that loosely. But I'm here to tell you that emphatically, it did not start in 1973. Only the musical aspect of hip hop. You should never start a culture with a break beat and a party. That's not going to get you. It's not going to get you far. You know what I mean? You started with hip hop. Hip hop was a self-sustaining, self-sufficient, socio-political, socio-political movement of survival activism. First, then they partied, and they had to create the peace themselves with the 1971 Gang Peace Treaty. So they had to create. So they did all of that themselves. We're talking teenagers. Instead of a gang war, making a conscious decision to know that, nah, this is not right. And this, what I deem, is the manifest destiny of hip hop. That decision of the Ghetto Brothers, instead of retaliating in their situation, they actually was like, well, nah, we're gonna do a gang peace treaty. This is ridiculous. And so without that, that is when, and that's 71. So Kool Herc doesn't get to throw a party in 73 if the Ghetto Brothers don't make sure that these 101 gangs in the Bronx can at least chill out for a few minutes. That's how hip hop, the music part, started, with the social activism and the intelligence of young people wanting peace instead of war. And that's what I want everybody to know.
Wisdom that really matters and brings us all together. That's what wisdom does.
Yes, that's and again, I like that you said that too. And then, like we were saying earlier, about this is not a race thing at all. The powers that be have been propagating this race thing on us, y'all, so that we go at each other's throats while they continuously pass crazy laws on us, and we're ignoring what they're doing to us as a unit when we're out here batting each other with something that they put in the mix for us to, you know what I mean, do. So it's a new world, and hip-hop is should be one of the main focal points of leadership, especially for children in this new world. So.
And yeah, it's not a race thing for sure, but there are, you know, the cultures are very distinct and unique from each other. But that doesn't have to be separate us. We can have respect for each other and appreciate each other and enjoy each other and maintain our individuality and maintain our individual cultures. But that race thing is such a manipulative lie. It's just such a
It's a headache.
It's a headache. But the culture thing, I mean, that's just, you know, get some curiosity. Let's see what we can learn from you, what your insights are. I mean, I've gained so much. I'm gonna have to go lie down and fan myself for a while after this conversation. I appreciate this so much, Fats.
I appreciate the consideration for having me. Thank you, Nini. I really appreciate it.
Oh my gosh. So enriching. So I'm looking forward to getting those cuts from you, and you know, we'll be in contact and we'll see how we can keep the knowledge growing.
Oh yeah. Like I said, anytime you need me for anything, you know, I know other topics too, or whatever. Like I said, I know you were saying me and you was building earlier and you're trying to get this thing going. You know, you was needing help. I'm here to help. I love your calls. I love what you're doing. Like I said, it's necessary. I like how people like you are. Okay, I need to be a part of this enlightenment, this new era of enlightenment. It's the age of Aquarius. I don't think people realize what's going on metaphysically, celestially. It's the age of Aquarius. It's not the age of Pisces anymore. So now we're in the age of air, technology, information. We're in the feminine prowess, the feminine power. You know, everything is kind of actually kind of going back to the good stuff. It may get a little rough before we get there, but these conversations right now, me and you couldn't have this conversation 25 years ago.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. We can have it now. And that's why I know already, it's already happening if everyone's paying attention. We're already moving in the right direction if everybody's paying attention. And so,
Ashe.
No doubt.
All my best to you and your family.
Oh, thank you. And the feeling is mutual.
Yeah. I hope I get to meet you in person someday.
Oh, we will. We're going to make that work. That's a promise.
Good. Yes. Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Peace and blessings.
Peace and blessings. So download that book of his at Amazon. You will not be disappointed. It's so much rich information that we couldn't discuss in this conversation. And if you would, please consider donating to this podcast so that I can hire tech support, so that I can engage in and share many more conversations. I can accept money on Venmo at Nini White, and monthly donations in any amount will be greatly appreciated. Thank you. Thank you for being here.